For decades, the United States Postal Service has been in crisis. Will it survive the pandemic?
A lot of these people are already working overtime, 10, 12-hour shifts as a result of the cuts to the Postal Service's labor force in recent years.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, April 16th, a look at how COVID-19 is edging the Postal Service closer to collapse. Then, with millions out of work, how some states' use of an old coding language is preventing people from filing for unemployment services.
Unfortunately, in a lot of issues in government, things don't change until they break or they're facing some kind of crisis. We might see the same reaction here.
Plus, the sexual assault allegation against Joe Biden and whether it could change the shape of the 2020 race.
Among at least the major party nominees, they don't have a choice of someone who has not been accused of sexual misconduct.
And to end on a lighter note, we look at how puzzles are helping distract us while we hunker down at home.
It really is a wonderful alternative to the screen because just physiologically, it's a lot more restful.
Today, the Postal Service plays an integral part in the lives of Americans of every age and station.
Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. That's the very unofficial motto of the United States Postal Service, which is 245 years old. Since its inception, the Postal Service has been through a lot. The vast expansion of the U.S., a civil war, two world wars, Y2K, the Great Recession. It has adapted to changing times and continued to offer its most basic, vital service. But will it survive this pandemic? The Postal Service has been facing deep financial hardship over the last few decades, long before COVID-19 pushed us into today's economic crisis. USPS is still delivering the mail during this pandemic, but there's trouble for the agency on the horizon. President Trump recently signed the CARES Act to bail out industries and individuals and to prevent the economy from collapsing any further. But that $2 trillion aid package?
I've never signed anything with a T on it.
Included no bailout for the Postal Service, only a proposed $10 billion loan that the service will have to pay back, and which will only keep the agency afloat for a short time. According to the Washington Post, President Trump explicitly refused to allocate any funds to the Postal Service and its vulnerable employees in the CARES Act. Meanwhile, Postal Service workers continue to put themselves in harm's way to bring us the mail. I spoke with Jake Biddle, a freelance journalist in Brooklyn who has covered the Postal Service for The Nation magazine, and Phil Rubio, a history professor at North Carolina A&T State University. I began by asking Phil about how the Postal Service got to the brink of collapse in recent years.
You had a politically manufactured crisis, starting with the 2006 Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act that told the post office, starting in 2007, that it had to set aside $5.5 billion per year for 10 years to pre-fund retiree health benefits. And the purpose of that was to balance the Bush administration budget. What it did was start putting the U.S. Postal Service deeper in debt every year. The Postal Service has not used any government funds since 1982. It was changed over from the U.S. Post Office Department starting in 1971 after the nationwide postal wildcat strike of 1970. So it's been self-supporting. But there was a crisis, postal financial crisis in 2009 as a result of the Great Recession. That was the first manufactured crisis. And now, 11 years later, we're seeing another novel, mutated version of that same crisis with President Trump refusing to offer any bailout funds for the Postal Service.
The Postal Service has a long history. It goes back 240 years.
245 years, actually.
245. Give us a little history lesson on how the Postal Service originated.
In 1775, the post office is born in wartime. It's one of the most revolutionary things about the American Revolution. And it was founded with the primary function being as a political and information network, in contrast to the European model, which was to raise revenue for the treasury. So you have the Post Office Department established formally in as a permanent feature in 1794, along with provisions for letter carriers. 1864, you have the railway mail service. You have rural free delivery in 1902, parcel post in 1913. So there are a lot of milestones of the post office being a part of American development.
There's a question of race dynamics in the Postal Service's history too, right, Phil?
The issue of race at the post office goes back to the early 1800s when there were a lot of politicians who were fearful of the Haitian rebellion and African-Americans learning more about it and also having access to something as crucial as the mail, a crucial infrastructure. And so they banned African-Americans from delivering the mail till 1865 with the conclusion of the Civil War. 1865, you start to see African-Americans migrating to the post office as a kind of job niche. That job was considered less discriminatory than the private sector. They could take advantage of Republican Party patronage and be appointed to positions until 1883, when you see the Civil Service Act. They can start taking tests now. And even though there's discrimination, they are fighting their way into the post office. They are fighting their way into postal unions.
Jake, I was wondering if you could bring us up to the current date and tell us how COVID-19, this pandemic, has affected the Postal Service.
So I'd say that there are sort of two main effects. The first one in the early weeks of the pandemic was that a lot of postal workers were forced to do their job without adequate protective equipment or disinfecting protocols. So, I mean, like a lot of people in the country, it took the Postal Service a while to stock up on masks and hand sanitizer. And because there are so many postal stations in so many different parts of the country, it took a while for the Postal Service to develop protocols that would work for mail sorters and letter carriers as well. So that has basically been resolved in a lot of the stations with the sources that I've spoken to. They are able to do their jobs with masks and gloves now. But the second main effect, and probably the more disastrous one, is that more than 750 postal workers have tested positive for the virus as of the most recent numbers, and more than one have died. And as a result, thousands of the workers have been put under quarantine. That severely strains the labor force, especially at smaller stations. So you're seeing disruptions to the normal mail operations. And in some parts of the country, they're having difficulty getting the mail out because a lot of these people are already working overtime, 10, 12-hour shifts as a result of the cuts to the Postal Service's labor force in recent years. So it's sort of made a bad problem worse in that way.
Who's most affected by this? Are there particular workers that are more affected by the pandemic than others?
I would say that the workers who are probably most affected would be those who sort the mail in the stations and clerks, because they work in close quarters a lot of the times. And then probably urban letter carriers in places like New York and Seattle, where the pandemic has progressed quite far, who they come into person-to-person contact with their clients and with fellow employees quite often. So I'd have to say that a letter carrier in a place like the Bronx or Manhattan is probably most at risk, just because there's the most person-to-person interaction.
And therefore, probably African-American letter carriers and postal workers would be more affected.
Certainly.
We know the Trump administration is refusing to provide a bailout for the United States Postal Service. Why? And what are the implications of that?
The first thing that needs to be clear is that the reason why you don't hear about the Department of Education or the Department of Energy needing a bailout is because, like Phil said, the Postal Service is entirely funded by, or almost entirely funded by, actual revenue from the sale of mail. It doesn't receive taxpayer money. So the motivations for denying the Postal Service a bailout are still a little bit mysterious to me, but it has been a Republican talking point for years that the Postal Service is unsustainable, that it needs to be privatized, that it can't go on. But as Phil sort of outlined, I think that the crisis that it was facing before is manufactured. It's not a real issue with the Postal Service's operational model.
Jake, what about voting by mail? There's been speculation that the Trump administration is refusing to bail out the Postal Service because of the voting by mail issue. We just saw this play out in Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. So in addition to delivering medicine and conducting welfare checks, the Postal Service delivers mail-in ballots. And given the potential for a second wave of the outbreak, vote by mail is probably an essential feature of the next relief bill. I mean, I could see, instead of trying to oppose the instituting of vote by mail by Congress, you know, the Trump administration could allow the Postal Service to fail and then sort of escape vote by mail that way.
Phil, even if it was funded, is the Postal Service able to carry out voting by mail? Does it have the capacity and resources to do it?
It certainly does. Already 1/4 of Americans vote by mail, mostly through absentee balloting. The Postal Service has had those kinds of resources. It was even an Obama executive order in case there was a biological terror attack that the post office or that letter carriers would be going door to door with vaccines, and that's still on the books.
Jake, is the Postal Service management doing anything to help postal workers given what they're going through and how many have been affected by coronavirus?
The management's response has been evolving rather quickly, but one of the first things that they did was institute a more liberal paid leave policy to allow employees whose children are at home or out of school to take leave in a more flexible way, and they've made scheduling a little bit more flexible. But I think that they are faced with a real labor crisis here, where there just soon won't be enough people in each postal station to get the mail out. And so one thing that they've considered is instituting a temporary hiring policy that would allow them to bring in potentially some of the Americans who've lost their jobs in the midst of the pandemic to supplement staffing at a lot of these stations. But, you know, I should stress that the number one priority should be making sure that the workers are actually safe.
Phil, I'm curious about the worst case scenario here. What would it mean if the Postal Service, given the funding shortages, were to be shut down?
We'll lose letter mail, parcels, we'll lose e-commerce. Every day, tens of millions of prescriptions come to American homes.
So, Jake, then, what needs to happen to secure the Postal Service's future?
Sure. So in the short term, it seems like Congress could easily just give them some money. They did in the first round of the CARES Act, and in the near future, in the second relief package, it would be a simple matter to just provide a temporary infusion of cash until mail volumes return to normal. In the long term, there are a lot of things that could be done to rescue the Postal Service from what Phil described as this kind of panic disorder. I mean, they could be relieved of the pre-funding obligation that he mentioned, or some politicians have also suggested a postal banking system, which I believe existed in a previous era, where the Postal Service could provide a kind of public option for banking in low-income or rural areas and could make some revenue thereby. I mean, there are a lot of ways that going forward, the Postal Service could be not just self-sufficient, but could invest in its future. It is a matter of political will. All this stuff has to be run through Congress, as I understand it.
Jake's right. And, you know, it's interesting that the U.S. Postal Service Fairness Act, H.R. 2382, passed with an overwhelming majority in Congress, including half of Republicans. So what's holding it up is the Senate and President Trump. So that could easily get the Postal Service out from under this debt obligation that it was imposed on it. And the $25 billion that the Postal Service is asking in cash as a bailout seems entirely reasonable, considering the $500 billion of essentially unsupervised loans that are being earmarked for the airlines, restaurants, and hotels.
Phil Rubio is a history professor at North Carolina A&T State University, and Jake Biddle is a freelance journalist in Brooklyn who has covered the Postal Service for The Nation magazine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
New York City's public schools have been at the center of the coronavirus crisis. As the largest school district in the country, in a city with the highest rate of infections and deaths from the disease, the New York City Department of Education announced this week that 50 of its employees have died of COVID-19. Now many are asking whether lives could have been spared, not just in the school system, but citywide, if schools had been closed earlier. Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo have not seen eye to eye on many aspects of the coronavirus response in New York, and that was clear again on Saturday when the mayor made this announcement.
After very careful consideration, I announced today that the New York City Public Schools will remain closed for the remainder of this school year.
Not much longer after the mayor's announcement, here's how Governor Cuomo responded in a press conference.
It makes no sense for one locality to take an action that's not coordinated with the others.
Is that action invalid?
That's his opinion, but he didn't close them and he can't open them.
His opinion. Here with us to check in on how COVID-19 is affecting 1 million school children, their families, and staff is Jessica Gould, education reporter for WNYC. Jessica, welcome.
Hey, Matt.
So clear this up for us. Are New York City public schools staying closed or will they open again before the end of the year?
I wish I could give you a really clear answer on this, but we don't totally know. I could parse the legality of it for you, but I think what's more important to recognize is that nobody really thinks these schools are opening this semester. It's just unfortunate that we had to get such mixed messaging from our leadership on this because things are really stressful for families and students. So to sort of ping pong back and forth between these two directives from the mayor and the governor just added to anxiety and stress.
Yeah. What are families and parents of school children and staff, teachers saying about the fact that this consequential decision came with this political bickering that New Yorkers have come to expect between their governor and mayor?
Yeah. I mean, I think even people who have come to expect this were pretty surprised that they couldn't get it together on this momentous decision. I'm just hearing a lot of frustration. Parents are frustrated already. As you know, it's so hard to homeschool and to work and take care of your kids and your household at the same time. And they were just looking for some clarity about what they're going to be doing for the next few months.
There have been at least 50 deaths within the school system that are linked to coronavirus. What do we know about those who have died?
The breakdown within the education department of who we've lost, it's 22 paraprofessionals who work with teachers in classrooms, 21 teachers, 2 administrators, 1 facility staffer, 1 guidance counselor, and 1 food service worker. And that's what we know so far. But getting this information was really hard. You know, a lot of the other agencies like NYPD and FDNY, the police department and fire department, have been giving updates on the lives lost in their agencies. But getting that information out of the Department of Education was hard. And they said they hadn't been collecting it in a unified way. They've started now collecting self-reported cases from members of the community. But there has been a push to really get this information out because some people feel that the mayor and the governor really dragged their feet on closing the schools and that if they had acted sooner, they might have been able to stop the spread in school communities and then throughout the city.
These deaths in the school district will undoubtedly leave many children and adults dealing with trauma. Are there plans to support them while remaining socially distant and keeping the schools closed?
What I'm hearing is that the Central Office of the Department of Education is dispatching counselors out to school communities that have lost members of their communities. And the other thing is that the mayor and chancellor said this weekend that a main focus of next year, going into school next year, whenever we start again, hopefully in September, in the fall, will be a trauma-informed curriculum. There's so much uncertainty for so many families right now. And there is an awareness that the schools will have to be responsive to that. I'm not clear exactly on what that's going to look like yet.
The other big and more immediate challenge is this virtual learning. How's that going? How are children across the system learning virtually right now?
It's a range. There are some students who say they're actually doing even better with virtual learning, but most of what I've heard is frustration among parents about having to juggle homeschool with their other responsibilities and passwords not working, sometimes having trouble logging in. And then there are students that I've talked to for whom the virtual interface is just not as effective for them as a learning mechanism. I was talking to a junior, and you know, junior year is such a a crucial year for students. His name is Edward Sanchez, and he's in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And he was an honor student up until this point. And right now he's worried about his dad, who's a truck driver, and his mom, who's a nanny and isn't working right now. And he's up all night, and then he can't get through his work during the day. And so his grades have been falling. We're still trying to find out whether these grades will matter as such, and how students are being evaluated. So it's unclear yet, you know, if these grades are even significant, but for him, watching them go down has been really demoralizing, and he sounds like he's a little paralyzed by it.
Wow. And do kids have access to computers and the internet in order to do the sort of virtual learning that they're supposed to be doing?
Right. I mean, the Department of Education has been sending out batches of iPads and other devices by the tens of thousands every week, starting with kids in homeless shelters and then kids in public housing and so on from there. But they say, as of last weekend, they were saying that there were still 240,000 kids who needed a device, who had requested one and didn't have one yet. We heard that Mayor de Blasio spoke to Apple CEO Tim Cook, and this New York City had gotten in the front of the line to get more iPads by the end of this month, and they are trying to get a device in the hand of every kid who's asked for one by the end of this month. But that's a huge lift, and I'm calling around this week to find out, you know, have kids gotten them? Are they working properly? Because I'm hearing things like, you know, some of them are password protected and they're not given the password, or they're getting a device, but it's not compatible with like Google Classroom or whatever they need to use to get online. So even if they have a device, there are issues, and it's not clear that every student has a device or will have a device by the end of this semester.
Right. And then if they do have a device, can they get online? Do they have internet access in their home?
Right. I mean, at first there was this concern because some of the companies offering internet access weren't allowing families that had outstanding bills to pay to get online. That, I think, has been cleared up, and now they are letting families do that. But again, a lot of families aren't connected, and something that came up at the press conference that the mayor held over the weekend is that there are kids, and it doesn't sound like a small amount of them, who the school system has lost contact with, and they're trying to regain contact, but the idea that there are kids who have fallen out of the system and off the radar is really troubling.
Jessica Gould is an education reporter for WNYC. Jessica, thanks so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Matt.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts. The presidential primaries have taken a backseat to coronavirus coverage in the media, but over the past week, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has been in the spotlight for sexual assault allegations by a former staffer. A warning to our listeners, what you're about to hear contains a graphic description of sexual assault, which may be difficult for some.
It happened all at once. The gym bag, I don't know where it went. I handed it to him, it was gone, and then his hands were on me and underneath my clothes. He went down my skirt, but then up inside it, and he penetrated me with his fingers.
That was Tara Reid, a former Senate aide on the Katie Halper show recently. Last month, Reid told the media that Biden touched her inappropriately in 1993. And last month, she disclosed new details to the press. The story didn't get much attention in the mainstream media at first, but when it did, questions arose over whether the Biden accusation was reported differently than allegations of sexual assault at Republicans like Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. For more on this story, we're joined by Anna North, senior reporter at Vox. Vox was one of the first outlets to report on this after Katie Halper and The Intercept broke the story. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know at this point about Tara Reid's allegations against Senator Biden?
We know that Reid first came forward to talk publicly about Biden last year. This was during a time when several women were coming forward saying that Biden had touched or kissed them in ways that made them uncomfortable. Probably the most prominent at the time was Lucy Flores, who was a former candidate for office in Nevada. She had written an essay about treatment by Biden that said that she said made her uncomfortable. And then Reid came forward and said that when she had been a staffer in Biden's Senate office, he had touched her shoulders and neck, I believe. She'd felt that was inappropriate and she felt uncomfortable. But later this year, she began to talk about conduct that was different. She said, in fact, that in addition to what she described before, she'd been sexually assaulted by Biden. We know that she reached out to the organization Time's Up earlier this year, and she said that she had faced harassment after coming forward last year. She hoped that that Time's Up would back her. They were unable to give Reid PR support because of their 501c3 status, so they felt that they couldn't get involved in something that was an allegation against a likely Democratic nominee because it would jeopardize their nonprofit status. So after that, Reid said that she decided to write about her experience on Medium, and journalists began contacting her, and she ended up giving an interview to the Katie Halper show in March, and she also spoke with The Intercept.
Have her allegations been corroborated by other people?
So The Intercept spoke with two people who were in Reid's life in 1993, which is the year that she said that she was assaulted by Biden. And they said that she did tell them about the incident at the time. One is a friend. The other was Reid's brother.
She recently also filed a criminal complaint against him, right? Is that right?
That's correct. So she also filed a criminal complaint in Washington, D.C. The statute of limitations on sexual assault is passed, as this happened many years ago. So she told Business Insider that she wanted to make it clear that I would be willing to go under oath or cooperate with any law enforcement regarding it, because it did happen, even if it was 26 years ago.
Can you put these accusations in perspective compared to other women who have spoken out against Biden?
What makes this allegation different is that it's an allegation of sexual assault. Several women, Flores included, have talked about behavior that made them uncomfortable, behavior that they felt was inappropriate, touching. Biden has responded to those allegations in a video message where he said he has always been an affectionate person, but that he understands boundaries have changed now and that he's going to change his behavior. But that whole conversation really became a conversation about personal space, about how do you act with people. And this allegation is one of sexual assault, so that makes it really different.
Now, you had mentioned Time's Up, the anti-harassment organization, and Reid had reached out to Time's Up for help with this, for help with legal representation. They opted not to get involved. Can you explain what kind of precedent that might set for other victims of sexual assault who want to come forward against politicians and politicians who may be nominee for president?
What Time's Up has said is Reed came to them and they did assist her, that they did attempt to connect her with lawyers who might be able to take her case and connect her with other information. Reed says no lawyer was willing to represent her. Time's Up says Reed had also asked for PR support. She wanted perhaps more people in her corner. And the organization says it doesn't necessarily give PR support to everyone who requests it. It's not able to. And in this case, says it was in a bind because it is supposed to be a nonprofit and it couldn't really be seen as getting involved in the presidential race. Another thing, Time's Up has gestured toward this, and I think it's true that Time's Up itself is really new, and even the climate that we're in, wherein people are coming forward with these allegations regarding public figures in a more public way than many of them had for a long time, thanks to the rise of the Me Too movement, I don't know that our society is particularly good at navigating this yet. And although there's much more support for people coming forward, we are probably not where we should be. And I don't know that we know how to appropriately deal with such allegations, how to support people who make them. What this incident shows is that, especially when the subject of the allegations is a politician, is running for office, it gets even more complicated.
Yeah, and it gets also complicated for the media. The Intercept and Katie Halper's podcast broke this story. But after that, you were one of the first outlets to cover this, and you decided to publish a piece even before the New York Times and the Washington Post. Tell me why you decided to hit publish on this piece.
People were asking why the media wasn't covering this more. And so our sense was that a controversy was already very public, and part of our mission is to explain the news, which includes explaining such controversies. So that's essentially why we decided we wanted to write something about this.
And there have since been stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post, right? I mean, they've started to cover this to some degree.
Yes, the Times has covered this. There's a news story. Columnist Michelle Goldberg has also written about it. And I do think there was a new level of coverage after Reed filed her police report as well.
We should mention, and you had mentioned this earlier, we reached out to Biden's campaign and received the following statement from Deputy Campaign Manager and Communications Director Kate Bedingfield. Quote, such claims should also be diligently reviewed by an independent press. What is clear about this claim? It is untrue. This absolutely did not happen, end quote. There have been numerous credible sexual assault allegations against Joe Biden's likely opponent, President Trump. Considering that, how does all this shape the choices that voters will have to make in November?
I think it's really hard. I think a really uncomfortable thing about the choice that voters will face is that they are among at least the presumptive major party nominees, they don't have a choice of someone who has not been accused of sexual misconduct. Now, I don't want to draw an equivalency between the number or nature of allegations against President Trump and the nature of this allegation against former Vice President Biden. But it's true that voters are going to have to weigh both of these men are people who have been accused of behavior that is inappropriate and behavior that's worse by women. And that's something that voters are going to have to figure out.
Anna North is senior reporter at Vox. Anna, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read more from the statement the Biden campaign sent us at thetakeaway.org. As of today, just over 22 million people in the U.S. have filed for unemployment due to the crisis spurred by the coronavirus pandemic. And this means an unprecedented number of people are counting on state unemployment benefits to stay afloat. But the influx of traffic to unemployment benefit websites has been too much for some state systems to handle. Here's one Takeaway listener who called in to share her experience filing for unemployment last week.
Hi, this is Mayor from North Carolina. I was furloughed 2 weeks ago in North Carolina. Due to site crashes, it was a couple of days before I could successfully get through the unemployment application process. It's impossible to get a live person on the phone, however, and while you can email questions about the process, you're not likely to get a response given the tremendous burden that office is experiencing.
Keep calling us about your experience filing for unemployment at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Last Thursday, The Takeaway spoke with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, who addressed some of the issues with his state's unemployment system, including the fact that it runs on a decades-old coding language called COBOL.
We've put, among other calls, to arms out for COBOL programmers, which I never thought I would hear myself saying. But listen, we are catching up, and folks have been frustrated because the spike in unemployment in New Jersey was like it is in many places in America right now, record levels. Folks rightfully want to have the phone picked up. They want the website to work. We are slowly but surely chopping through all that.
New Jersey is far from the only state struggling with outdated software for its unemployment system. McKenna Kelly, a policy reporter for The Verge, reached out to state labor departments for a recent investigation and found that more than a dozen have unemployment sites that run on COBOL. I asked McKenna to explain why states are struggling to find COBOL programmers to strengthen their unemployment systems during this crisis when millions are out of work.
COBOL came into fashion in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of those programmers are retired. So when it comes to trying to fix these systems later on, it's very difficult to get those people, A, to come out of retirement, or B, to have them teach new coders how to use the language.
So what are states then doing? Like, how are they finding people to help work these systems, given that there's such overload, given the people filing for unemployment on systems that rely on COBOL?
Right. So for one example, I spoke to the folks at the Colorado Labor Department. They only had one person working on their unemployment systems before the pandemic hit. Now they are bringing one more on. There's also organizations like this group called COBOL Cowboys in Texas that is a bunch of older COBOL fluent programmers, and they help governments and private industry find these coders for help in times of crisis as well.
And why? Why have they not gone to something more modern?
Upgrading a system like this takes a lot of time and money, and the return on investment just really isn't that great. It also has to do with budget priorities. In state budgets, modernization has not been a priority, and the federal government has continued to make cuts to modernization over the past 25 years.
I mean, I imagine that even more modern systems could still be overloaded by the huge influx in traffic that we've seen in recent weeks because of the unemployment numbers. But what are the specific weaknesses that you found for the unemployment systems that run on COBOL?
COBOL has been modernized too. There has been an updated COBOL language, but still a lot of these systems exist on this very old COBOL pre-modernization language. So A, that language does not pair well with modern infrastructure and hardware. So when I spoke to the folks at COBOL Cowboys, one of New Jersey's problems was that they only had one processor running, and it was difficult for the language to adapt to more modern or stronger processors in order to compute all of that data that they're currently receiving.
You mentioned New Jersey. The Takeaway spoke with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy last week, and he's put out calls for COBOL engineers to volunteer and help out with his state's unemployment system. Have the volunteers been coming forward to help New Jersey and other states?
I'll tell you what. Over the past 24 hours since my story has been up, my email and my Twitter DMs have been filled with either retired COBOL programmers who are looking to volunteer, or even younger programmers who are looking for resources to learn the language in order to help out. Now, I don't know if there's a coordinated effort to get them into these governments, but a lot of people are really excited to try and get to work.
Is there anything that Congress can do at the moment to help prop up some of these unemployment websites and these unemployment systems?
Last week, President Trump kind of signaled that he was interested in including some infrastructure language in the next stimulus package. So in that, Congress does have the opportunity to appropriate some money for modernization efforts across the country, because these are the systems that are delivering that extra $600 in unemployment benefits, and they're getting all this money out to people. But when the systems are crashing, it's hard to get that money into the hands of people who need it most right now.
And do some states have modern systems that are efficiently processing these unemployment claims?
From the states that I have spoke to that have updated, it didn't seem as though they are facing the same kind of problems that the older systems are. Some have already updated to Java and other coding languages. Others are using a kind of Java and COBOL pairing in working towards modernizing. The folks that I spoke to in Colorado, they were intending to update their system in a month or two. So this pandemic kind of hit at a very odd time and in an unfortunate time for the people trying to access it.
So will some states now try to update their systems midstream here while they're in the process of dealing with all these claims?
That's what we have to see. But when you hear folks like Governor Murphy and other government leaders in states all across the country, they really are feeling the pressure. And I think this crisis, unfortunately, may be what pressures them into updating these systems, even though people have been calling for this for years.
So people have been sounding the alarm about this before the pandemic, and now finally the rest of us are realizing what's going on here?
Right. I mean, unfortunately, in a lot of issues in government, things don't change until they break or they're facing some kind of crisis. We might see the same reaction here.
Things don't change in government until they break. I think I'm going to remember that phrase. Thank you very much. McKenna Kelly is a policy reporter for The Verge. Thanks so much for joining us.
So great to hear from you.
We're going to end on a playful note by talking about something that's a good fit for those spending a lot of time indoors hoping to find some inner peace. We're talking about jigsaw puzzles, which, like toilet paper and Clorox wipes, have been flying off the shelves. So much so that puzzle manufacturers are having a hard time keeping up with consumer demand. In the last 2 weeks of March, one of the world's largest puzzle manufacturers, Ravensburger, saw sales go up 370% in North America compared to the same time last year.
Hi, this is Jerry Lynn from Bedford, Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I've put together a 300-piece puzzle, five 500-piece puzzles, and a 600-piece puzzle, and we are building ourselves back up to the 1,000-piece puzzles that are still lurking in our closet.
For those of us sheltering in place, the appeal of puzzles isn't all that puzzling. Whether you're starting small with 100 pieces or dreaming big with 1,000, puzzles are a safe way to socially distance that doesn't involve Netflix. For more on the popularity of puzzles, we turn to someone who spends a lot more time thinking about them than the rest of us. Chris Byrne is a toy historian and consultant with thetoyguy.com. I asked Chris about the history of puzzles, specifically when we first saw the jigsaw puzzle as we know it today.
The first jigsaw puzzles were in the 18th century, around 1766. A cartographer by the name of John Salisbury cut up a map of Europe and pasted it to a board, cut it up, and used it to teach geography to his students.
And then what came after that? How did the puzzles evolve in the 20th century?
Back in 1908, puzzles were one of the hottest things for Christmas. And that was a time when people didn't give gifts quite in the same way that we do today. It was more traditional to give somebody a card to celebrate Christmas. So there were at-home puzzle making kits, so you could take those cards and cut them up and put them together as a puzzle. So it was sort of like a double gift, and those were quite the rage in 1908. Fast forward to the 30s and the Depression, and we started to see the more die-cut puzzles like we know today. During World War II, when people had to be in blackout, puzzles were very popular. And they've really stayed popular throughout the years. There was another bump in the 60s when Springbok puzzles came out with the first licensed puzzles with popular characters, Mickey Mouse and Snoopy and all of those. And then the 80s with the home game boom, really touched off by Trivial Pursuit in 83, we started to see a lot more puzzles around, and they've really never gone away.
Video games and the internet didn't suppress the popularity of puzzles at all?
Not at all. And I think the reason is that they were always sort of a small sector of the toy industry, but it's a very different experience. Sitting around a table with friends or by yourself doing a puzzle and being quiet is very different from, you know, trying to get Mario through the most complicated track.
So now what explains the current resurgence of puzzles in popular culture? At my house, because of our social isolation due to coronavirus, we finally pulled a cat puzzle off our shelf from the company Puzzles So Hard, and it is so hard, by the way, but very rewarding. Are we seeing a resurgence in puzzle popularity because of this pandemic, or did it start to creep up even before then?
Well, I think it's definitely been because of the pandemic that we've seen such a big spike in recent months. And I think it's for a lot of reasons. It's something that people can do together. It's not competitive like a board game. It's something you can do a little bit of and then walk away. So I think it's it's kind of an ongoing activity that people enjoy, and it's very relaxing.
Because it's slow. It is slow fun, right?
It's slow. And you know, when you are sitting there going, I need that corner of the barn, or I need that cloud, or I need this thing, you're not really thinking about anything else. So it really does make it possible for you to take a little mental break from all the other things you might be worrying about at the time.
I'm wondering what social media has meant for the puzzle world. I've been seeing a little bit on Instagram and TikTok, people showing off puzzles.
It's kind of along the lines of showing off the dinner you made, or showing off anything that says I did something. And it's a way of reaching out to other people and staying connected. And I think that's one of the most important things that we've seen in this coronavirus world, has been the need for people to stay connected through their activities. And that's happening virtually.
So what makes a good puzzle? What are the ones that are quite popular? And is there a particular reason that makes them popular and good?
Well, it starts with the image. It absolutely starts with the image and the quality of the image. And it has to certainly be one that appeals to you. You want to be able to spend several hours looking at this picture and having it come together. I also think that because it's a tactile process as well, a really nice quality cardboard that feels good when you like push that piece in place, I think that's important as well. And you're holding the little pieces in your hand and turning them around. There's that tactile satisfaction as well that I think is really important.
Are there strategies that you'd recommend for people who are new to puzzling? I mean, for me, how do you start a 1,000-piece puzzle? I told you I was working on this puzzle from Puzzle So Hard, and I think the first thing that we did was try to get the edges right in the corners. Is that considered the appropriate strategy?
Yes, I think you want to sort of lay that out. I would tell anybody who is very brand new to puzzling, something called Puzzle So Hard might not be where you want to start. But I always say look for an image that is really well defined in kind of blocks of color or blocks of photography. So you're not trying to get, 87 different tulips that are all identical all at once, because that can be frustrating. And start with a smaller puzzle piece. Start with a 300-piece puzzle, a 500. Work up to the 1,000-piece puzzle, or then the 40,000-piece puzzle that Ravensburger introduced at Toy Fair this year.
Wow, 40,000. That is intense. Before we let you go, I was wondering if you think our renewed interest in activities like puzzling will make us rethink maybe how we spend our time and how time moves after this pandemic is over.
I certainly hope so. And I think that it really is a wonderful alternative to the screen, because just physiologically, it's a lot more restful to look at a puzzle and to socialize around a puzzle than to watch that constantly moving screen, even if we don't see it as moving. I do think that if we slow down and take the time to connect around that, and we've learned that, we will get through this, and that time to connect and have a shared activity, I think is something that's hugely important for individuals and families and groups of people.
Chris Byrne is a toy historian and consultant with thetoyguide.com. Chris, thanks for joining us, and happy puzzling.
Thank you. Same to you.
Many of you told us you're puzzling or taking up other hobbies while sheltering in place.
Hello, this is Barbara calling from Red Bluff, California. I am just keeping with my baking habit and trying to step it up. And I have been able to transfer my anxiety about coronavirus to my anxiety about flour. Who is buying all the flour?
I've been crafting with my 9-year-old. We've been catching up on all those birthday and Christmas craft kits, painting, sewing, pottery, drawing, jewelry, slime making, you name it.
Whatever you're doing at home during this time, we're grateful that listening to The Takeaway has been a part of it. Before we go, a quick shout out to the team that makes this show with a lot of hard work and a lot of heart every week. Our producing team is Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, Amber Hall, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Our senior producer is Alexander Boti. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Jose Olivares is line producing, and Katarina Barton is our intern. David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Our director this week was Vince Fairchild, alongside engineer Debbie Daughtry. And we had a big remote assist from director Jay Cowett. From all of us, we appreciate you listening every day. I'm Matt Katz. Lizzie O'Leary is back with you next week. Stay well. This is The Takeaway.